Hey, welcome. So I'm Jason Kipnis. I'll be the presiding officer this morning. First, one opening comment. I've been told to inform everybody that for CLE credit, you need to sign up each day. So if you signed up yesterday, that's great. But if you want credit for today, you need to sign up today as well. To kick off today's presentation, we're going to have a panel on IPR and post-grant review. As we all know, since the passage of the AIA, IPRs have become increasingly utilized as a way to challenge patents. And we have a distinguished panel here. To introduce this panel, we have moderator Brian Kwok, who is a partner at Haynes & Boone's Palo Alto and Shanghai offices, where he helps clients build, manage, and successfully monetize patent portfolios. So take it away, Brian.
Great, thank you very much. Can you all hear me okay? No? Yes? Hello, hello, hello? You guys can hear me now? No. Hello? Is this better? Oh, here we go. All right, I'll just hold it like this. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming so early in the morning. We're excited to be here, and I hope you all are as well. When I was asked to moderate this panel, I thought how lucky we were to have such a distinguished a roster of panelists. And it should be okay now. Here we go. All right. And so why don't I go ahead and introduce everybody. But just before that, I just want to set the tone, which is we really want this to be a kind of an interactive conversation. So we'll have some questions and we'll have some slides and the panelists will answer. But really, to the extent you have follow-up questions or more nuanced follow-up, we totally invite that and hope that you will raise your hand and I will call on you. So, so to my left, I'm happy to introduce Mike DeVries. He's a partner in Kirkland & Ellis' Intellectual Property Group. Mike represents clients in complex intellectual property disputes with particular focus on technology companies and patent litigation. He has handled trials in a variety of other litigation-related matters involving patent, trademark, and copyright infringement, misappropriation of trade secrets, false advertising, and unfair competition. If that wasn't enough, he has served as lead counsel on a variety of patent and other intellectual property-related matters, including serving as lead trial counsel in a 5-week federal jury trial involving chemical technology and a variety of intellectual property claims. To his left is Judge Peter Chen. Many of you may be familiar with some of his decisions. He is a judge with the PTAB who was appointed administrative patent judge in August of 2013 and now is currently a lead administrative patent judge based in the West Coast Regional Office in San Jose. He presides over AIA trials and has been paneled on over 150 IPRs and CBMs. Prior to being appointed to the PTAB, he practiced intellectual property for 30 years at law firms and as in-house counsel. He is a named co-inventor on 2 U.S. patents. And finally, last but not least, I got it backwards, that would be unfortunate, all right, is Terry Ray. She's a partner in Crowell & Mooring's Intellectual Property Group. Terry, you may all know, is the former acting and deputy director of the USPTO, as well as acting and deputy undersecretary of commerce for IP. She brings a wealth of domestic and international experience and skills to her practice, both legal and political. Her practice concentrates on working with clients in several key areas, including IP policies and strategies, patent enforcement and post-grant administrative proceedings, trade secrets policy and enforcement, and digital internet-related copyright issues. So welcome, panel, and thank you very much for coming today. We thought that one great way to get started with our panel was really to talk about some of the most up-to-date, or relatively up-to-date, PTAB statistics. And I think a lot of us have seen this presentation in various incarnations, but this one is relevant as of October 31st. And Judge Chen, if you wanted to take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. So I appreciate everyone being here at this early hour. What I'm going to do is go through some statistics regarding what we're seeing at PTAB. This will be current as of October 31st. The November data is still being processed, but this is quite up to date. Now, before we do that, I guess I will have the obligatory show of hands for everyone in the room to raise your hand if you've been involved in an AIA trial before the PTAB in any capacity, as outside counsel of record, as a party in interest, as a real party in interest. So that's great. That's a very sizable percentage. And just for background, at this same panel 2 years ago in 2014, when I asked that question, you could probably count the hands on one hand. So that's just indicative of the nature of the process and how prevalent it's become in patent litigation. So these statistics, and they are current as of the end of October. The fiscal year ends on September 30th, so we're now in our third month of the new government fiscal year. So this first slide just describes the number of petitions, and when you add in November, we are now close to 6,000 petitions filed in a little over 4 years of the AIA process. So we're lucky to have Terry on the panel, and she was inside the agency when the due diligence and investigation and analysis was being done on what these regimes, IPR, CBM, PGR, might mean. So Terry, how does this figure compare to what you and your team were analyzing back in 2011 and 2012, now that we've had 4 years worth and roughly 1,500 petitions per year?
We were way off. So we had no idea exactly how popular these would be, because everyone was used to litigation. So we didn't realize how this would be dovetailed and would actually be considered parallel or something to always be considered during litigation. So we had to come up with a number, because Judge Rader at the Federal Circuit sent a letter to the USPTO. It wasn't an email, it was an official letter, saying that he was worried about the number of appeals he would be getting from the USPTO from these PTAB proceedings. And so Judge Rader actually made us really focus and say, come up with a number. You know, we had an approximate number, but we'd give Congress broad ranges. Congress didn't exactly care as long as we could keep up with it. So when Judge Rader sent us the email, because he wanted to guesstimate the number of appeals that would overwhelm his court, which is indeed happening right now, we gave the problem to Rader. Dave Kappos and I were there. We gave the problem to the solicitor at the time, Ray Chen, because he would be defending those cases before Judge Rader. And isn't it interesting how life comes around and goes around? So Ray Chen worked with us and came up with an estimate, an actual number estimate, a very lean and mean estimate, just so that the Federal Circuit could know what was on its way to them. And we just underestimated it significantly. The popularity of the PTAB proceedings, the IPRs in particular, far exceeded our expectations. Lawyers by nature are not risk takers. We're very conservative. We have to be with our clients, right? So you have to be creative if you're an inventor, but if you're a lawyer, you have to be conservative and try and use your best guess. So we had no idea how popular these would be. And I actually remember the days where, you know, the old days where re-examinations first started, and hardly anybody used those, and then there were parties re-exam. I mean, life is an evolution. And this, IPRs were embraced for the first time by far more members of the user community than we could have ever expected. So in terms of the AIA, everybody was talking about first to file, first to file. If somebody in Congress, whether a staffer or a congressperson called, it was always first to file. They never asked us about these. And then once the AIA went into a force, in effect, nobody cared about first to file anymore. And it all became about the AIAs, which just goes to show you, or goes to prove, you can never anticipate the future. Judge Chen?
Thank you very much, Terry. That's great background. So our next slide just shows a breakout of the petitions by type. Overwhelmingly, it's been IPR with some CBM, and PGR is just beginning to become noticed. Now, it's been a fairly steady state, as you can see. slight drop from fiscal 15 to last year. Next, this is numerically by month. So the main takeaway here is on the bottom right, the number of total petitions filed by month. And you can see that within a range, plus or minus maybe 15 or 20 per month, we're around 150 total petitions still being filed monthly. We had quite a spike in early 2015, and luckily, I guess, for the APJs, it's leveled off a bit since then. We're still having quite the volume, though, and it is, as I say, remarkably steady, with 140 to 160 or 170 still being filed every month. Just speaking in the back room before this panel started, we were talking about how we've seen data that roughly at any given time, 80 to 90% of what's occurring at PTAB has a parallel component in the district court or at the ITC. So that prediction, I think, has borne out as far as litigants in infringement litigation taking advantage of the PTAB process. By technology, mostly electrical, computer, software, some mechanical. Biotech is increasing. I think the last time I was here in 2014, the biotech filings might have been low single-digit percentage, and now we see that they're climbing a bit, and I think the expectation is that might continue. Okay, this slide focuses on the patent owner. The patent owner, remember, gets two filings. After the petition, the patent owner is obliged to file a preliminary response upon which the panel of APJs decides whether or not to institute. And if there is institution, the patent owner gets a formal response. But focusing on the preliminary response, the first paper filed by the patent owner, you'll see that it's been fairly consistent as well with the overwhelming majority of patent owners taking advantage of the opportunity to file a preliminary response. It's not mandated, but again, it's been quite consistent for patent owners to do so. You're probably aware that earlier this year there was a rules package that was promulgated, which included in the CFR an amendment so that patent owners are now able to, in addition to filing the response, which is essentially attorney argument, they may also now file a declaration from a technical expert, and that will aid and assist the panel in looking at the institution decision. So on institution, you can see that by and large, it has been a fairly consistent percentage. Any given month, it might vary plus or minus a few percent, but for the high technology side of the petitions, you know, typically somewhere a little over two-thirds, between two-thirds and three-quarters of the petitions will result in institution. There is a noticeable difference, though, in the biotech pharma area that we've seen, and that is a lower institution rate for those petitions. Okay, these are bar charts which play out a bit the institution source of decisions, and you can see that this is just another way of depicting what I just described as far as percentage of petitions that will be instituted, IPR, CBM, and PGR. And again, PGR is just in its infancy with the eligible patents having been filed in March of 2013 and later. And so they are now being issued, and we expect that the PGR filings will continue to increase. Settlements have risen quite a bit. When I was here in 2014, the percentages were not great. As far as being maybe between 20 and 30%. Now we're seeing an even higher percentage of cases settling out, many before the panel reaches the institution deadline. Some occur after the institution deadline, and some occur even later in the process. I saw this morning on one of our internal messages that this week a panel approved a settlement in a matter where the oral hearing had occurred a couple weeks earlier. So that's unusual, but settlements are occurring at all stages of our process, and you know, we expect that as we have a little more time and we're in our fifth year, more results, more data, the users of the PTAB processes can come to expect a little bit more in terms of consistency and certainty, and that I think that helps promote settlement windows. Okay, this is what is called internally the stepping stone slide, and it's probably a good time for me to remind everybody that what I'm saying is strictly on behalf of myself standing here and is not intended to be the voice of my colleagues or the board or the agency as a whole. And it's useful for me to say that in the context of this slide, simply because this is one way to depict outcomes. And really, for me, it might be a little difficult to see, but at the very, very bottom, we have a yellow, a golden hexagon, and then a green hexagon. And what that essentially tries to depict is that in about a third of the final written decisions, remember there's that preliminary response, and then I talked about the formal response that the patent owner has, and the petitioner gets to reply, and then we have the oral hearing, and then the three-judge panel sits down and comes up with its analysis and the final written decision. In these final decisions, about a third of the time, one or more of the claims that were instituted upon are found to be patentable. So that was the intent, at least that's my interpretation, of these stepping stone slides to show that perhaps contrary to some commentary that was seen early on and maybe continues from various commentators and the like, it's not an automatic situation where if institution occurs, then the final decision will follow that. You know, to the contrary, in at least about a third of the final decision, some of the claims that were instituted upon will be found patentable once the record is complete, the depositions have been taken, and the panel has had an opportunity to review all the evidence. So this is for IPRs, and then we have a similar one for CBM. Not quite the same percentage, but my personal view is this is a much smaller sample size. So on a lot of these data sets, IPR is probably the best indicator simply because of the higher volume. Another way that the agency depicts the life cycle and what we've seen is in these cylindrical views, and these are just slightly different way to present what happens to claims. And so this is one way of showing that in all of the petitions that had been filed, there were over 124,000 claims in those various patents that were in those various petitions. Now, of course, many of those claims were not even challenged in the petitions. So you back those out and you have a slightly different percentage. But ultimately, the idea of the cylinder is to show that it's not as if every claim in every patent that's challenged is being found unpatentable. You know, again, to the contrary, a lot of it is the choice of the litigants in not electing to challenge certain claims. And then once you get through the process, a much smaller number of claims are ultimately found unpatentable. So this is as of October 31st, the cylindrical representation. Same thing for CBM. And I don't think we do this for PGR simply because there's only been a handful of final decisions on PGR so far. So finally, we have the outcomes for instituted claims by technology. And again, focus on the green bar at the far right of each of the bars, and the green shaded area shows that, again, in biotech, there is, I think, a distinction with a difference in the number of claims that are being found patentable in the final decisions in the biopharma area relative to high technology. So, you know, that concludes the statistical snapshot. I think we're very lucky to have, right after this panel, at 9:30, the regional director from my office of the PTO in San Jose, John Kabeka, will speak, and he may have additional thoughts on some of these statistics. I hope many of you have met John. If you have not yet, I would commend you to do so. He is a veteran of the agency, started out as an examiner. He's been with the agency close to 30 years, although he doesn't look it. When you meet him, you'll say, how did that happen? But John has a wealth of institutional knowledge and will speak to some of this in his remarks. And I see at least one of my colleagues in the audience as well, so we have some APJs in the room, which is great. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Chen. One of the interesting things I saw on your slides was one statistic that showed the number of settlements that occur pre-institution is greater than the number of settlements after institution. And that seems to me a little bit counterintuitive to the extent that once you've instituted, you've already kind of overcome one evidentiary hurdle or burden hurdle. What do you think's driving that, or do you think there's just no, you can't really make any speculation as to what's going on there?
Well, personally, it's starting to remind me a little bit of a district court where how many of us had cases settled with a summary judgment motion pending? So the petition has been filed, and the petition has been termed by some a high point for the petitioner because they have marshaled their evidence. They've got their expert declaration, and they've made their presentation. So I see some parallels with district court summary judgment where the motion's been filed, and both parties, I think, are acutely aware at that point of the possible consequences if the trier of fact rules on that motion one way or the other. So that may be driving both parties to think about resolution before there's an official declaration or resolution of that particular paper. So that's my personal view on it. We don't have any particular studies internally, but to me that would make some sense once the patent owner sees what is on the table from the petitioner, it may be motivated to consider resolution.
Right. And Mike, I don't know in your practice, I think, what we've seen is the quality of that's required of an IPR petition in the level of specificity is quite a bit higher than what you would see in a district court complaint. And maybe that's what's driving some of that as well.
I definitely agree with that, and I agree with Judge Chen that and you, Brian, that the petition is much more akin to a summary judgment motion where you've actually laid out your position. And I think that the dynamic of settlement at the point in time of pre-institution decision speaks volumes of the significance of the institution decision. And the statistics that Judge Chen showed that institution on claims doesn't necessarily equate to cancellation of those claims. You can divide the numbers up in a variety of different ways, but let's call it a third of the institutions did not lead to all the challenged claims being canceled. But in a very large percentage of the time when an institution decision happens, there is a cancellation of all the claims. And so I think that provides an incentive for the party. It's a good incentive, frankly, to take a careful look at the evidence that's been presented and to think about settlement prior to institution rather than viewing institution as akin to the institution of a district court proceeding or an ITC investigation.
Great, thank you. So next, we're really privileged to have Terry on our panel, and I think the audience would really enjoy hearing about some of your work as a leader of some of the AIA initiatives and post-grant proceedings that we're now living through. We've got a few years under our belt with some great statistics, and kind of what to what Judge Chen was alluding to, you know, how has post-grant proceedings, really met your expectations or maybe diverged from your expectations from the planning early on?
So probably my biggest overall impression that you rarely hear me say is that really I'm amazed at how well they work. Because we had very little time from when President Obama signed the legislation September 16th of 2011. The PTAB, the new PTAB was created and up and running within a year. We need an entirely new IT system. That's where we came up with the patents, PRPS, yeah. Now it's end-to-end. It's just changing names is never good with me. But even coming up with an IT system, and we engaged with the user community. We found out, let them know what our preliminary thoughts were. People provided comments. We revised it. And then within 11 months after the legislation was signed, had to be in the Federal Register in final form, which meant we didn't exactly know with our new IT system, even what the new, how everything would even work. I mean, and if any of you have ever set up a new IT system, you need a lot more time than that. And the usual approvals to write new rules usually takes, we say, 16 to 18 months in the government. We had to have all this done in less than 12 months. So the fact that it actually is fully functioning, nothing in life is without complaints, but I think it's actually the PTO did a really good job and they continue to do a good job. One thing we recognized early on is that no matter what we did with the rules, they weren't going to be perfect. Because things change, the user community is going to use them in different ways. We knew that our best guess and our impression wouldn't be perfect, so we anticipated revisions to the rules right off the bat, and indeed that's been done and will continue to be done in the future. So the PTAB and the PTO still continues to engage with the user community, and you're going to hear some frustrations a few users have today and things that people would like to see modified to be made more efficient. And I'm sure that the PTO is going to listen to that and to see if it makes sense for both parties to keep balance with these PTAB proceedings. So there will be constant revision. So we knew we didn't hit it right the first time, but we did the best job we could, and I'm actually pleased that it's actually working. PGRs, the original intention of PGRs was to be more akin to European oppositions, and we wanted those to be more vibrant and bigger and more often used than IPRs, because it has to be a first-to-file patent, so only patents filed on or after March 16, 2013. And we wanted, within 6 months of a patent issuing in the first-to-file world, we wanted people to challenge it. So we wanted PGRs to be very robust. If we issued something that shouldn't have been because we overlooked something, we wanted people to use PGRs. Now, PGRs were not originally intended to have the reasonably could-have-raised estoppel language, which may be a problem to their robustness. And with PGRs, you can use not just 102 and 103 prior art, but 101s, 112s, everything's fair game pretty much other than
best mode
and statutory double patenting, obviousness type double patenting. So most things are fair game other than just very few areas. But the PGRs, I'm concerned, won't be as robust as we had originally planned because the estoppel, the or reasonably could have raised issue, where if you file a PGR because you have a piece of prior art, are you now stopped from ever bringing a 101, a 112, and any other art of which you will later become aware? So PGRs may not be as robust as we have wanted. You never know what the future holds, and people are lobbying Congress on a variety of issues right now, so you never know. We might get some statutory modifications to the PTAB trials.
Just one question on that is, you said it wasn't really what we intended. Wasn't the whole problem with estoppel and PGRs attributed to a Scrivener's error?
Yes.
So I think between what was presented to Congress and what the president actually signed into law, somebody decided to add some words.
Right. And so after a piece of legislation is passed, you have a few months afterwards where you can correct typos and inadvertent errors. But this went to substance. And so there's no way you would have any, there were people grumbling in the user community that if we modified the AIA to take this out of the PGR, that that was a substantive modification and would require more activity by Congress to make that change. So yeah, there is, whenever legislation is passed, there's oftentimes typos essentially, or someone inadvertently forgets the word not, and everybody goes, okay, we should add the word not because it changes the whole meaning. But in this case, that wasn't going to happen because it was so substantive. Discovery, Congress intentionally wanted these post-grant proceedings to be as frugal as possible, as efficient as possible. So Congress did not want the million-dollar discovery type issues in PGRs and IPRs as you've had in, as you have in district court litigation. So Congress did envision very limited discovery. Indeed, that is the case now. There's very, 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 very limited discovery. You only ask for something if you already know exactly what it looks like, exactly what it says. There's no fishing expeditions allowed. The only time there's a little bit of flexibility from the PTAB, I almost think, is early discovery, early on, when it comes to RPI, real parties in interest. You know, they might give you a little bit more flexibility, but very limited discovery. And frankly, most people don't even think to ask for it. It's just so limited. So it's something to always keep in mind, but not necessarily something to ask for, because that it might not go anywhere. 18 months, handling these start to finish within 18 months, I would have never guessed that every single one of them is in that time period. I mean, the board has done a truly impressive job and thereby gotten the confidence of federal district court judges, many of which stay their proceedings to wait and see what happens before the PTAB. They would not be as comfortable staying their proceedings if they didn't have that dependability of 6 months in the petition phase and 12 months in the actual trial phase. So I think that we've gotten more of the confidence of district court judges by the PTAB really trying to hold themselves to that time period. The number of judges, early on it was pretty obvious that we needed to ramp up the number of judges. So we started hiring judges even before the AIA went into effect. And then once the AIA went into effect and we saw how the filings, while they're not as robust as they are now, even those early filings exceeded our expectations. So we really ramped up the hiring of judges. We were able to get Judge Chen pretty early on, which was a good thing. The caliber of judges that we hired, James Smith, former Chief Judge James Smith, he had a very, very high standard for the judges. And I said, James, not all of them have to be that good. Just start hiring people. He did a very arduous, very aggressive hiring process. Was your hiring process easy, Judge Chen?
It took only about 9 months.
So. Yeah. So it takes a while, and they have you go to the PTO in Alexandria. They meet with you. They see how you handle your handle yourself, you know, just on your feet without any prep. It was because to those of you who have done PTAB proceedings, a lot is done by telephonically with both parties and all the judges on the other side of the phone. And the judges will hear your question, put you on hold, convene, and get back to you. So you have to be the type of individual that can think quickly, think on the spot, develop a consensus, and move things along, because otherwise these 18-month proceedings would not be 18-month proceedings. So he was very cautious. He got high credentials, people who could think on their feet, and it still amazes me the talent that we were able to get at the PTO. And if you've noticed, very few judges have actually left. The attrition rate is still, I think, incredibly small. You talk to any judges, whenever I run into any of them, they still think they have the best job in the world. So I think that's, you know, a testament to the group and a testament to the PTO. And also, they like these proceedings. They like engaging with the user community. The last point I wanted to make was claim amendments. That's something that I guess I improperly, because I had done a lot of patent prosecution also early in my life, I just assumed, as did Congress, that the ability to amend your claims that one had in inter-parties re-examination would also be present in inter-parties review. But in inter-parties re-exam, you have GS-15, talented examiners who do nothing but examine. But with the AIA and the PTAB, those are not examiners. Some of them are. But most of them were not trained as examiners. They're litigators, most of them situated similarly to you in the audience. And examining is not second nature to them. And they're judges. They're judicial. They're not examiners. And so I think their comfort level with examination isn't as high as with true examiners who have spent 20 years doing it. And I really didn't think that part through, and I think quite a few people at the PTO didn't really think that through. But Congress fully intended the robustness of examination to be comparable to inter-parties re-exam. But to any of you who did inter-parties re-exam, that almost was, it almost ran amok, because people would cancel 200 claims, all 200, and add 350 more claims. And you say, oh, you're exaggerating. No, I'm not. And so these highly talented GS-15 examiners in the central re-exam unit who handle those inter-parties re-exams, they weren't under any kind of a count system. They just took as much time as you needed to handle it, and it had to be handled that way because they wanted to handle it right, because they knew it would be appealed to the old BPAI or PTAB, and then they knew it would be appealed to the Federal Circuit, so they did a great job. So when you think about the robustness of claim amendments that were allowed before inter-parties re-exam, that was never going to be matched by the by the PTAB under the AIA, because it took too much time to do that. However, the AIA did sort of envision that moderate abusive process, if you'd like to refer to it that way, and to say if you deleted a claim, you could add one. But still, think about the number of claims that some of these IPRs have. They are tremendous. Some people limit their number of claims, and other people, there's quite a few. So claim amendment issue, maybe we'll get some clarity soon. I think Aqua Products is an en banc Federal Circuit decision that we might have a chance to refer to later, that Brian might get to, that might help address that. But I think we need a bit more clarity or certainty there. I think that BRI, broadest reasonable interpretation, was something that was very emotional with the BPAI judges. They had to have that. If they couldn't operate outside that world, that's just how the PTO thought. That's how everybody was trained. I never thought BRI was a giant issue. We might have a chance to get to that later. But I do think that claim amendments is something that maybe that should be resolved in one way or another sooner or later. Most people have the message, and very few people are filing motions to amend claims at the present time, just because it's futile and you don't want to ruin your position, put it that way. Make it look like you needed to amend the claims, and if you couldn't do so, that perhaps the board should hold against you. But at any rate, so nothing in life works out as planned, but in general, Judge Chen, I think the PTAB is doing a terrific job.
Great, thank you, Terry. Well, let's actually talk about motions to amend, and then we'll pivot to another topic. Motions to amend, in IPR and PGR proceedings, I'm sure you all know that the patent owner has the opportunity to amend his or her claims. Currently, of the 118 motions to amend that have been made, 95% have been denied. And so the PTAB has actually held that the patent owner bears the burden to show a patentable distinction over the prior art of record, and also the prior art known to the patent owner. So the In Re Aqua Products case that Terry referred to was actually heard this morning. Oral argument was held before an en banc Federal Circuit panel. And really they were really asked to consider two things. One, who has the burden of persuasion regarding the patentability of amended claim? And let's say, for example, the petitioner doesn't object to an amended claim. Can the board then just sua sponte start rejecting those claims and challenging those types of amendments? In IPR, 35 U.S.C. Section 316E says the petitioner, not the patent owner, has the burden of proving unpatentability by a preponderance of the evidence. So I just would open up to the panel as to, you know, what are your thoughts on that position? And really, you know, it seems common sense to me that if someone's trying to amend their claims, they should be challenged in some way, just like you would through normal prosecution, And so why is this such a big deal?
I guess I will observe something, and I don't know that this directly answers this question, but I represent patent owners in a fairly large number of district court and ITC litigations and have IPR experience that is largely interplays with litigation. My own perspective really matches that that Terry just described, and that is that the standard is so exceptionally high that I believe that seeking leave or filing a motion to amend the claims appears or feels like an admission that your patent claims are invalid, and that has an in terrorem effect on the patent owner and makes it a really, really tough decision to decide to move to amend the claims. Perhaps that's not a correct perception, that seeking leave to add amended claims is an admission that there's any problem with the current claims, but I do think that regardless of the rightness or wrongness of the current standard, I do think it leads to an outcome that highly disfavors going down that path.
Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah, I think that for patent owners, some of the claim amendments they've requested for consideration were imminently reasonable, but the PTAB is reluctant to look at them, and maybe it's limiting things to 18 months, and I know it's difficult. So I don't think we should put Judge Chen, ask you at this time, because Aqua Products is being decided. And, you know, they will take their instruction from the courts, depending on what the courts decide. But it can't be a robust claim amendment, robust examination. That's not, it's some type of narrow type examination. And of course, the issue with claim amendments is who has the burden. So I know how the PTAB looks at it. If you want to make claim amendments, the burden is on you to show each and every claim to be patentable over, they tell you, in idle-free products, over art of record, art you're aware of. You know, they tried to limit the universe, but you're also given a rather limited number of words to use to justify those amendments, so it's kind of difficult right now. So I think just a bit more clarity there would be helpful. Frankly, though, as I indicated, for the most part, people very rarely request to file a motion to amend. They just don't do it anymore. It's like discovery. You know, the answer is going to be no. It's like asking your parents. If you know the answer is going to be no, and they're both going to say no, you don't even ask. Well, that's what you're down to now also pretty much with motions to amend. And there's times where I thought, boy, if they just could amend their claim slightly, it'd be terrific. But I think, Judge Chen, we won't put you on the spot for this one, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, so we've heard a lot about kind of the benefits of IPR at the PTAB, and I wanted to ask Mike about, you know, how do you weigh when, you know, pursuing an IPR or a PGR at the PTAB versus a district court or ITC litigation? Is there any reason why you would do them at the same time? And in particular, one question I've always had was, isn't it helpful to have concurrent litigations, at least to the extent that you can use some of the discovery that you get from a district court litigation in some of your PTAB filings?
Sure. I'll speak to that briefly. I'm appreciative to be on this very esteemed panel of practitioners, and I've been very grateful to hear the insights that everybody has had. As predominantly a litigator, my view of IPR proceedings and to a much lesser extent PGRs is that they're in a relationship with litigation, and I believe that they are. It is mandatory to think about this these proceedings in every single litigation. When we file, sometimes we've taken over a number of cases from less experienced counsel who would not be attending this kind of an event, and I am shocked that even to this day, how many patent lawyers or litigators are just not familiar enough with this process. It is a very important part of every single litigation that must be considered. But I'll make a couple of observations about that briefly. One is that I think that the decision, if you're an accused infringer, whether to file an IPR needs to be very carefully considered. And so this is now from the perspective of somebody who's an accused infringer. I think that there is somewhat out there in the world a perception that IPR is a free shot. That is a free shot that can be taken irrespective of sort of whatever else you're doing. And I don't think that that's correct, and nor do I think that that should be the proper way of analyzing when to tee an issue up to the PTAB for resolution. I see far too many cases where I feel like accused infringers file petitions against every single patent, every single claim, and I'll observe one other aspect of that in a moment, but there's not enough judiciousness in the process. And if you're looking at it just from the perspective of the party who's been accused of infringement, that can lead to some real problems, right? As Judge Chen pointed out, 2/3 of the time claims don't get canceled in these proceedings. And there can be very important impacts in litigation. There are, of course, the estoppel ones. And I think in deciding whether to file an IPR petition, the frankly relatively narrow scope of estoppel around IPRs and the fact that it only applies to patents and printed publications, I think, is an enormous reason why there is such a high volume of these petitions, because there are other arguments that will remain if that strategy is unsuccessful. But I'll also note that there are other types of impacts that I think people don't consider enough when they file a flurry of petitions against every single claim at the beginning and then sometimes also in the middle of litigations. And that is that when that strategy is not successful, that can have a very real perception impact on the judges. And I think there is a risk for sure that will be, it's gonna be litigated heavily around motions in limine at trial, but certainly could be before the jury. And that's in addition to whatever estoppel is there. And then the only other second thing I wanted to say is that I have seen, and this is really representing a patent owner's perspective, an absolutely very large number of serial petitions that are being filed. I think that this system, one of its goals, and I recognize it's not the only goal, is to simplify resolving these kinds of issues. Before very talented judges who have an extremely, a lot of experience with these issues, and I think it can be a very good platform for resolving certain invalidity issues. But I have seen across case after case after case, circumstances where accused infringers are filing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 petitions against a single patent. I had a recent case where with one patent, there were 6 petitions that were filed. And I think that that is symptomatic of people not doing enough on the front end when crafting their petitions to make good decisions about what to file and not to file. And I commend the PTAB for the steps that they've taken to deal with that dynamic. I think that it's important. And I'll just observe that even in spite of those efforts, I am seeing that dynamic occur in case after case after case where what we end up with is frankly a system where we have a complex litigation either in district court or the ITC, and then just an absolute proliferation of the number of petitions that are filed.
Great. And just to follow up to that, with respect to estoppel, you said, one thing that makes IPR attractive is the fact that the effect of estoppel is fairly limited. At the end of the day, that also applies to PGR. Well, actually, that's the opposite for PGR because there are so many more grounds that can be covered. But at the same time, there are people who are saying, hey, we're afraid to file PGRs because of the estoppel effect. But the people who are deciding, the PTAB is a very sophisticated body of adjudicators that wouldn't you want them deciding those types of issues rather than a district court who's got a whole bunch of other, case law to deal with and may not be specialized in patent law?
So I guess I'll briefly give my thoughts, and then it would be interesting to hear if Terry or Judge Chen or anyone else has a comment on this. Yes, I believe that the system is a very good one for resolving these types of issues. And so, you know, I think that to answer your question very directly, it is definitely a situation where I feel very comfortable having these issues decided by the PTAB. And so I think that is a big benefit. I think at the same time, and this isn't reflective of the PTAB, I think this goes more along the lines of what Terry said. It is, you know, as lawyers, we are conservative, and if you sort of take a shot and it doesn't work, you're always going to be thinking about where that could leave your client. And I think that one reason people have pursued PTAB challenges in the IPR context with more frequency is that if you have, for example, system art that is not going to be subject to the estoppel, or, you know, maybe we can argue about that, but that there's a reasonable expectation that it won't, that you're not putting as many eggs in one basket. Because I think that one of the observations I've had is that as this system has developed and been, you know, robust, and I have every confidence it will continue to be robust, if you're looking at it from a litigation context, you know, there is going to be, as Judge Shen showed, two-thirds of the time where you are back in an adjudicative proceeding and you're going to be facing either a judge or a jury, and, you know, you're going to have to think about what that world looks like. And so dealing with estoppel, especially if it stops you on every single aspect of your invalidity challenges, could leave you arguing simply on these damages are too high. And that could be an uncomfortable place to be in if you're in front of a jury.
Just to follow up, and then we'll move to our last topic, PGRs are, you know, we saw in Judge Chen's statistics that are actually infrequent right now. And Terry mentioned that maybe one reason for that is the unfortunate drafting issue with respect to estoppel. What do you see as the future of PGR? Do you think it's going to be more popular nevertheless? Do you see it as, you know, a tool that just unfortunately was stunted because of statutory drafting?
So I haven't filed a PGR yet, but for two of my clients, I am looking at doing so. And keep in mind that you have a wide number of patents whenever there's a controversy. So some patents may be more amenable to a PGR, and you can get rid of the issues quicker than in a district court litigation. So, you know, everything Mike said, I agree with everything that he said, but as we all know, everything is case specific. So you look at the situation, how many patents, how many claims, and even if there'll be a worst case scenario and the estoppel is far worse than what we now think it is and what we think it envision it, let's say it's a worst case scenario, with these two clients of mine, it's worth the quote-unquote risk to file a PGR because we think we can dismiss them early. So I think for right now, PGRs are not as popular because you have to have a first-to-file patent, a patent filed on or after March 16, 2013. So there's just, but however, as further we get away from that, more patents will have issued after that date. So it might get a bit more robust, but right now, most of the patents that I look at are before that date. They're in the first to invent world. So all I think of is IPRs for right now.
Right. Last topic is actually one that's really interesting to me, and it's diversity before the PTAB. Many district courts recognize an experience gap between today's current lead counsel and their successors. And to help address this, courts have explicitly encouraged firms to use younger, less experienced attorneys, oftentimes giving that party more time, more pages, even holding hearings when they normally wouldn't, which can be a great advantage to a client's case. So, Judge Chen, I didn't know if you had any insight into that with respect to how you run your docket, and also to Terry and Mike, have you successfully used some of these orders from court to encourage this type of participation from younger attorneys to help your case?
Well, yes, thank you. And yes, the PTAB, we're definitely aware of these so-called next-gen proposals and orders that have become more prevalent in the past couple of years. certainly here in California, in courts in Texas, Georgia, and elsewhere. In fact, last winter at an event, a conference at Santa Clara University, our then acting chief judge, Nate Kelly, was on a panel where some practitioners discussed the next-gen issue. And I can certainly say that the board leadership and the APJs were well aware of the next-gen initiative. I think we're generally very much interested and supportive in concept. It's under consideration. There has not been any promulgation of a rule or some standing order at the board. I would say that just personally looking at my docket, I think it's occurring somewhat organically. It's very anecdotal, but I've had probably half a dozen hearings where the petitioner or the patent owner, or in some cases, at least one case, both sides appeared to utilize, from my perspective, the next-gen counsel to argue a portion of the issues at the oral hearing. Now, we're disadvantaged a little bit compared to district court or ITC in that, as you know, the oral hearing is the only one single opportunity for a live in-person interaction with counsel. Everything else, as Terry indicated, is typically done by telephone, which is certainly live but doesn't have quite the immediacy of being in the room with the trier of fact. So, going forward, it wouldn't surprise me personally if more petitioners and patent owners utilize their outside counsel on things such as phone calls, the initial conference call, or a phone call about RPI, or a motion for additional discovery, or can we have a reply to the patent owner preliminary response, various other procedural issues, depositions, et cetera. But again, from a big picture standpoint, we're well aware of the initiative, and we'll see how things develop at the board in its consideration of it.
Great. Mike, Terry, any additional?
No.
Great. I think we have 1 minute for questions. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to? Great. The young gentleman back there.
Curious whether any of the panelists have seen any cases where the institution, either a failed institution or a granted institution, in the subsequent proceedings were utilized in a trial. So ability to say, hey, we've already passed muster on a failed IPR, or rather for the defendant to say, hey, we had an institution and the PTAB is, the patent office has gone back and rethought this patent that's issued.
Yeah.
So I have not, so I have definitely seen that that circumstance have an impact in the pretrial proceedings before the judges, and I think that's not surprising. I have not yet seen a circumstance where the jury, where someone has been able to present to the jury that there's been a failed institution attempt, although I think it's potentially coming. And I think we're going to see more of the IPR decisions in front of juries, just as we have in at least some circumstances with failed reexaminations and the like. And so exactly how that plays out, I think, is going to be a big fight. But I think it's enough of a palpable future reality that it's something that's worth keeping in mind.
So I have one anecdote there. I'm more on the life sciences side, so Hatch-Waxman, so it's not a jury trial. So if the petitioner was unsuccessful and it was not instituted, the patent owner immediately goes to court. Judge, it was not instituted on any of the claims. Much lower hurdle. You've got to do clear and convincing. You just have to do preponderance of the evidence at the PTAB. Your Honor, PTAB, these three highly sophisticated judges didn't find even a modicum of evidence to look at any of the claims, so they didn't institute on any of them. And at that point, you could have essentially a gold-plated patent because you didn't have the worry about going to a jury if you're in Hatch-Waxman or a life sciences-type litigation. So yes, I agree with Mike that you have to be really careful. If you're a petitioner, you have to really think it through. And your petition is your entire case in chief. You can't add to it before the PTAB. So you can't file an IPR frivolously or without really a lot of thinking and how it plays into everything. I mean, even if you say there, estoppel is going to be no problem, I've seen the non-institution of an IPR work to the patent owner's benefit in a Hatch-Waxman proceeding.
Great. Well, we're out of time, so Terry, Judge Chen, and Mike, thank you so much for spending your morning with us, and let's give them a round of applause.